This morning, I wanted to start out with a reading, and Lori asked me yesterday, well, what you're talking to me about? And she said, you know what you're talking to me about? And I said, kind of. But then I saw something this morning, and I changed my mind about what I was going to talk about. So, and what got me to change my mind is this little book, which I picked up. It's an old edition or old copy of Raja Yoga or Mental Development by Yogi Ramacharaka. And the reason I picked it up is I was talking to Lori this morning about how when I started meditating, when I was 17 years old, I started meditating, and there were no teachers or centers around where I lived. So I checked out books from the Long Beach, California Public Library, and they had a couple books on yoga. One was Light on Yoga. I started with that one. I started teaching myself yoga postures from the book because, as I said, there were no teachers. And then this, I believe, is one of the books that I found. This one on Raja Yoga. It dates to 1905. The talks that were transcribed was from 1905, and this one was published in 1935. This is old material. I'm sure it's older than that. And I picked it up and just flipped open to the first page of text, which is called The First Lesson. And I felt it was so appropriate to Zen practice that I'm going to read it to you and then we can talk about it a little bit. In India, the candidates for initiation into the science of Raja Yoga, when they apply to the yogi masters for instruction, are given a series of lessons designed to enlighten them regarding the nature of the real self, and to instruct them in the secret knowledge whereby they may develop the consciousness and realization of the real I within them. They are shown how they may cast aside the erroneous or imperfect knowledge regarding their real identity. Until the candidate masters this instruction, or at least until the truth becomes fixed in his consciousness, further instruction is denied him. For it is held that until he is awakened to a conscious realization of his actual identity, he is not able to understand the source of his power, and moreover is not able to feel within him the power of the will, which power underlies the entire teachings of Raja Yoga. The yogi masters, I like where they say the yogi masters, they didn't say yoga masters these days, but the yogi masters are not satisfied if the candidate forms merely a clear intellectual conception of this actual identity, but they insist that he must feel the truth of the same, must become aware of the real self, must enter into a consciousness in which the realization becomes a part of his everyday self, in which the realizing consciousness becomes the prevailing idea in his mind, around which his entire thoughts and actions revolves. To some candidates, this realization comes like a lightning flash the moment the attention is directed toward it, while in other cases, the candidates find it is necessary to follow a rigorous course of training before they acquire the realization in consciousness. The yogi masters teach that there are two degrees of this awakening consciousness of the real self. The first, which they call the consciousness of the I, is the full consciousness of real existence that comes to the candidate, and which causes him to know that he is a real entity having a life not dependent upon the body, life that will go on in spite of the destruction of the body, real life, in fact. The second degree, which they call the consciousness of the I am, is the consciousness of one's identity with the universal life, and his relationship to and in touchness with all life, expressed and unexpressed. These two degrees of consciousness come in time to all who seek the path. The path is in quotes, the path. To some it comes suddenly, to others it dawns gradually. To many it comes assisted by the exercises and practical work of Raja Yoga. The first lesson of the yogi masters to the candidates leading up to the first degree above mentioned is as follows, that the supreme intelligence of the universe, the absolute, has manifested the being that we call man, the highest manifestation on this planet. The Absolute has manifested an infinite of forms of life in the universe, including distant worlds, suns, planets, etc., many of these forms being unknown to us on this planet and being impossible of conception by the mind of the ordinary man. But these lessons have nothing to do with that part of the philosophy which deals with these myriad forms of life, for our time will be taken up with the unfoldment in the mind of man of his true nature and power. Before man attempts to solve the secrets of the universe without, he should master the universe within, the kingdom of the self. Kind of cool, huh? 1905. So what I found interesting about this, I found a lot of things interesting about it, but is one of the things I found the most interesting is the distinguishing between an ordinary beginning of awakening experience and a more in-depth, what they call the I Am experience, which in Zen would be considered a true enlightenment experience. So we have this series of pictures over there, the 10, what they're called the 10 ox herding pictures, usually. And they relate to different states of mind or different states of experience that one has when they're on the spiritual path, the path of awakening. And the initial experience of having a glimpse of awakening in that series there is the third picture down, which is called glimpsing the tail of the ox. In other words, the ox is a metaphor or a symbol for the what's called Buddha mind, or what Scott Killeby in his book Living Realization calls awake awareness. So having a little glimpse of this awake awareness, of seeing all of a sudden there's the possibility of experiencing a kind of awareness which is outside, or which seems to be outside of the experience of the confined ego self or the confined ego mind. And sometimes when we have that experience, we think it's the biggest experience that anyone's ever had, and we've got it. But as you can see on there, it's only number 3 out of 10 stages on that particular map of awakening. And there's other maps too, but that one is a particularly accessible one. So in Zen, the first thing that we usually do in the training is orient people towards at least a glimpse of this awakened mind state, which we can call awake awareness for the sake of this talk today. So awake awareness is just a synonym for Buddha mind. Buddha doesn't mean anything to most people, so I think awake awareness is maybe a better way of expressing it. Sometimes it's called unborn mind, or awakened Buddha mind, or God, or, you know, this universal consciousness. There's all kinds of ways of describing it. But all of these things are simply descriptions of something that really can't be described in words. The words point in the direction, but they can't get us to where the experience is. Only through dropping self-consciousness and dropping our dependence on the self, our fixation on the individual ego self, can we experience a glimpse, our first glimpse of that experience of the awake awareness. And then throughout our path, if we continue on the path, the point is to enlarge upon that experience so we can have what he's saying here is the I Am experience. The I Am experience would probably be equivalent to the ninth level of that particular series there, where there's just an empty circle, meaning there's nothing. There's nothing in, there's nothing out, there's just whatever is. There's just I Am, there's just awake awareness being present all the time. It's also important to know that the awake awareness does not negate the existence of the self and does not impair the existence or the functioning of the self. In fact, awake awareness, when we get firmly rooted in awake awareness, it enables the self to function clearly and effectively within the realm in which the self functions, which is the realm of feeding us, watching TV, raking the leaves, you know, relating to other people, that kind of stuff. And we can't ignore the realm of the self. When we ignore the realm of the self, we end up hurting ourselves physically, We end up messing up all our relationships. We end up confused and sick or whatever. So the self needs to be respected, but we also have to understand that when we see, as he said here, the body or man is a manifestation of this awake awareness, that the ego self is always going to be attached. It's always going to want more than it has. It's never going to be 100% satisfied, because that's the nature of the ego itself. It's the nature of the ego is to acquire more things for the being, to create more safety for the being, to create an island of stuff around the being so that it's safe. You know, we call those things houses. But sometimes the big floods come and the houses aren't safe anymore. It's a very powerful blow when something that you're that attached to, that kind of safety that you've created, is all of a sudden all washed away in a hurricane or a flood or whatever, right? So the self is always going to be wanting to acquire and always going to wanting to be making things better than they are. And honestly, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing even wrong with that from the perspective of a spiritual practice, provided we understand that impulse and that self is simply a part of awake awareness. It's simply a manifestation. Or as in Scott Killeby's book, he talks about it being an appearance. He says, the ego self and everything that comes along with it is an appearance of awake awareness. An appearance of awake awareness. So awake awareness is this ever-present or ever-presence that's always there, always functioning in a certain sense, but it's beyond the realm of the human. It's beyond the realm of the human ego. It's beyond the realm of the human ego to even perceive of, really. It can only be experienced when we release the attachment to the ego itself, which again does not negate the functioning of the ego. It actually enables the ego to work more clearly, because it puts in perspective that the ego function has its use, and the less impeded the ego function is with the conflict that occurs when the ego is assuming the central position instead of awake awareness assuming the central position, that disappears when awake awareness, when we're aware to the point where we see that everything is an appearance of awake awareness. So for instance, the ego feels it's the center. The ego feels that everything is in the universe to serve it. And when it isn't served properly, it gets angry or it gets fearful. We all have experienced that, right? So we can't ever make that really go away, because there's always death there. No matter how straightened out we get life, there's always death, and the ego has a major problem with death. You know, the major problem is it can't conceive of its own ending, you know, which is a problem. So humans invent all kinds of ways to make us feel better about that happening. But in any event, the more we can get the big perspective. So Zen practice is all about perspective. In fact, I think life is all about perspective. When we're focused on the small picture, which we do sometimes have to be, by the way, of course, to get things done. But if we're overly, is probably a better term, if we're overly focused on the small picture, then we ignore the big picture, and we ignore that the small picture has a place, but it has a place within the big picture. It's not an island by itself. We think we do things ourselves, but we don't. The bacteria do it. I was reading a thing recently about how there's the weight of our body, 2/3 of our weight, or over 50% of our weight, is actually bacteria. That we have billions and billions of bacteria. Everything we think our body's doing, our body's not doing it. It's the bacteria that are doing it. And so normally we think, ooh, I want to get rid of those bacteria, but they're all functioning in our body. We can't live without them. So we think, I am strong. But no, your bacteria are strong. I'm not really that strong. I'm dependent on oxygen. I'm dependent on the sun. I'm dependent on other people. I'm dependent on so many things. This idea that we're really independent is silly, if you look at it carefully. But again, the ego clings to this notion of independence. So when we're able to drop that and relax that and say, okay, ego, go sit over there for a while. We know you're there. You're always talking to me. Let the ego go sit in the corner. The technique I use is, okay, go sit in the corner for a while. Sit on a little stool and face the corner and let me experience the rest of existence for a while. Because the ego is a very small part of it. It's an important part, but it's a small, tiny little part. It becomes so predominant. And the more predominant it comes, guess what? The less happy we are. The less happy we are, the less satisfied we are, the less awakened we are. The more awake awareness becomes the center of what's going on with us, the more the Buddha mind or awake awareness becomes our central organizing principle, the more that things flow. And then the ego is actually happier because things are flowing. The ego likes it when things flow. It just wants things to flow the way it wants them to flow. And it doesn't always work that way. Sometimes it flows in a different direction. So the more we can get the big picture, the more we're in tune with the flow as it is instead of the flow that the ego wants to be. Sometimes it lines up and the flow is exactly the way the ego wants. You know, it does happen every now and then, but not all the time. In fact, not most of the time. And so what the ego does, that part of ourself is always trying to twist reality to fit its picture of how things should be going. It requires tremendous energy, by the way, to do that, and it's rarely very effective. How can one individual ego affect the flow of the entire universe? It's silly when you think about it. How can one ego affect the energy of another, one other person? Have you ever been in a relationship and tried to control someone else? How well does that work? And how well do they like it? And how well does the relationship go when we're attempting to do that? Not well at all, right? So when we're able to relax into this experience of awake awareness, then the universal flow becomes the guiding principle, so to speak. And we're able to see, okay, the ego wants it this way, but it's not how it's flowing right now. So I'm going to float down the river that's actually moving by me instead of trying to create a different river. Because a different river is impossible for the ego to create. It's too big of a job. And so then the ego gets exhausted because it's always trying to do something it's not designed to do. The ego's not designed to control the universe. It's designed to control simple everyday things. And when it stops trying to control the things that it cannot, then the everyday things we can actually exert more control over. We are better at them because we're not exhausting our energy trying to control what cannot be controlled, which is almost everything. There's maybe what, 0.00001% that we can control, and those are things we probably should be controlling. So in Zen practice, we always start out with the glimpse. Can we experience a glimpse? And then can we enlarge upon that? And when we start to when we have our first glimpse, and many people have it before they ever start Zen practice, or they have it in some other practice, or they have it, you know, when they're high on LSD, or they have it when they stub their toe, or there's all kinds of ways to have an awakening experience. Have it during a yoga posture or during pranayama, maybe. But you have that experience, and it's so wonderful to have that little glimmer of the possibility of the expansion of experience and the expansion of mind, right? That you want to get back there. And of course, then that becomes the obstacle because the ego has immediately appropriated the experience and it wants it again because it likes it. It wants the same experience or even a better one. You know? But that's not how you get there. You never get there by the ego getting back there. You get there by letting go more, allowing that awake awareness to manifest more, experiencing the flow of awake awareness and the flow of our life and harmonizing ourselves with the way with who we really are instead of who we think we are. We may not be who we think we are when we start this out. we may think we're the great musician, but when we really get into it, we realize I'm not that good. That's what I realized. I played guitar for many years, and I was a semi-professional for a while. And there was a point at which I realized that I studied with some really great jazz guitar teachers, and I realized I'm not good enough by nature. I can practice and practice and practice, and I can be pretty good, but I'm never going to be as good as this guy. I just saw it all of a sudden, and then I dropped it. I realized I'm not going to try and be a professional jazz guitarist anymore. Even the professionals aren't making money anyway. But I realized my nature wasn't to be that good of a musician. I practiced for many years, practiced hard, but I didn't have that natural talent for it, which was required in addition to practice to be able to make a living at it. So it's kind of like that. We get in tune with who am I really? What is my purpose in being here? What am I doing here on planet Earth? You know, that awareness comes, that understanding comes through really getting into that flow and seeing what is my function here? Why has awake awareness manifested me? And what am I doing here? And then when we start getting in touch with that, it's like really powerful. Like, oh, now I see what I'm doing with this life. But then we can really direct our energy to accomplishing what we really feel we need to be doing, and not on so many sidetracks that exhaust us and expend needless hours and days and months and years. So hopefully this has been valuable for you all. If anyone has any questions or discussion about this, we can do that.
Can you say something about how a specific practice technique in meditation might begin to point towards this?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look on that chart, you'll notice that there's a couple preliminary steps to the chart, I mean the painting over there. The first one is the little guy is wandering without any direction. So that's the first step. You don't even come here unless you're on the second one of those, right? There'd be no reason to come to a meditation center if you were just totally lost wandering around. You have to have some sense that there's something you can learn here or something you can learn through meditation. And that would be the second one where the little guy sees the tracks. Doesn't see the actual ox yet, but sees the tracks, right? And that's, of course, a metaphor for having some sense. There's a reason why all these people have been teaching for thousands of years. And maybe we read a book, or we knew someone else who'd done it. That's often how we get into these things. You know, some friend of ours does practice and says, wow, this has really helped. Or we notice that person has changed in some way, and we want to know, how come you've done this? How come this has worked for you? Or we read a book, or we go to some class on a lark, and we just happen to encounter, and we start to see the footprints, right? So chances are, if someone hasn't at least seen the footprints, they're not. Now, the footprints might not be the exact path that you're going to end up getting to that, reaching that experience of having the glimpse. So you have to experiment. And in Zen, anyway, the experimentation takes the form of the meditation itself, which is sitting. And of course, in many Buddhist practices, that's the form the experimentation starts with, is sitting. So to answer your question, what the sitting does is it enables us to focus on the inner kingdom, as you said in this Raja Yoga book, the inner kingdom instead of the outer kingdom, which ultimately are not different, but they appear to be when we start out, certainly maybe even for many years they appear to be. And we begin to be able to get perspective on what's happening. So first when we start sitting, all that happens is just constant activity. No perspective, constant activity. And eventually, if we sit enough, we begin to be able to get into the perspective of the observer, right? These are kind of the classic mindfulness steps. First, just sitting in confusion, which is what Zen teachers do after they finished all their practice. We just sit in confusion all the time. But it's different when you start out. And then the second step is to be able to to see that the confusion's happening here and there's an observer that's observing the confusion happening. And it doesn't seem like a big step, but it's a huge step. It's huge because we finally see I can be the observer. I don't have to maintain awareness in confusion and pain and suffering all the time. I can observe, draw away from. So that's space being created, right? So at first, we're creating space of perspective. Like I was saying earlier, it's all about perspective. So initially, we begin to get this perspective of, well, the suffering's here and I can observe it now. So I don't have to be in it all the time. It hasn't ended, but I don't have to be in it all the time. I can observe it happening. That creates that amount of space. And it's all about, at that point, creating more space. So the more space we can create, the more we can observe clearly on an inner level, this is happening, but it's not all of who I am, right? And then eventually we reach a point where, at least in Zen practice, the point, once we've had enough experience with meditation that we can observe, is we practice becoming one with, and becoming one with a koan, or becoming one with a visualization, in the case of maybe some Tibetan Buddhist practices, or becoming one with a mantra, in the case of some yoga practices. And the minute we can really drop the ego and become one with something, then we have that glimpse of being, of connection, you know, of connection to all things. Does that answer your question? Any other questions or discussion?
So thank you. So do we usually end with the four bodhisattva vows? It's on the inside of the front page.
Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Practice paths are boundless. I vow to study them. The enlightened way is incomparable. I vow to embody it. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Practice paths are boundless. I vow to study them. The enlightened way is incomparable. I vow to embody it. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Practice paths are boundless. I vow to study them. The enlightened way is incomparable. I vow to embody it.
Announcements. So as I mentioned, it's not that easy for Sensei Al to travel here and be away from home for 3 days and make sure things are taken care of at the Zen Center in Melbourne. So please support him generously. Please visit the Donna Box on your way out. And also for those of you that don't know, Sensei Al has a Zen Center in Melbourne. If you're ever traveling through the area, it's a great group of people there and really neat place to visit. And he also does a lot of online work. This is the modern day Zen way of interacting. So if you want to, you know, get to know Sensei Al a little bit better, he's available, so you can talk to him about that afterwards. We'll have coffee at Kujani today if anybody's interested. And the last thing I wanted to throw out there is Kat and I are back to work with the orchestra next week.
All right.
And if you're interested in doing something really different, a different way of practice, I view, come hear percussion, playing for music for little kids, all percussion, five of us. This is Saturday morning, really designed for little kids, but also for inner children. So, really fun, lighthearted music next Saturday morning. If you want to know more, email me and I'll send you a link. It's always just a joy for me to see friendly faces out there, so.
One other thing, we'll be doing a retreat, kind of an inner sangha retreat, November 8th through 12th. It's a four-day retreat at Kashi Ashram, which is in Sebastian, Florida. It's about 3 hours from here. It's about a half hour from Melbourne, where we live. And it's a yoga ashram that a really great place to do a retreat at. We rent space there a couple times a year. And so there's flyers on that here if you're interested in that.
I'll just leave the flyers here.
Yeah.
And I was just going to add that this was one of the reasons that Sensei Al is here is because it's our second anniversary of being open. So, you know, thank you for being part of it and practicing with us. It's really been wonderful for Lori and I. And I hope that everyone feels that this is, you know, the center is your center. It's here for you. So.